It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 380 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so very much for listening. This week, I've got another doubleheader episode for you. Things start off with Caleb Palmquist, one of the driving forces behind A Small Favor, and a related book, Welcome to Earthworld. We talk about how these series came to be, and what kind of plans he has for the future of this franchise, among other things. Then everything wraps up with Tom Saki, who has worked with others to bring together Offbeats and Ultrabot Go Go Go. If you like something different, I think you're going to like what Tom does. And these books are great books for great variety in reading, which is, of course, something I treasure. We talk about how you can access these books, as well as what kind of things he might have coming in the future, including that Ultrabot Go 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 book, which is going to be coming very soon, the end of this month. These are both great comics creators, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Caleb Palmquist, creator of A Small Favor, Welcome to Earthworld, that just completed a successful Kickstarter. Always a big thing, a big accomplishment. How are you doing, Caleb?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. And we were talking before I started to record about the fact that you just came back from Emerald City Comic Con, you lucky guy. You had a good time?
Oh, yeah. It was fantastic.
That's great because I love that con. We were there last year, but I didn't make it this year, so I'm a little jealous, but... It was good stuff. Now, let's get back and talk to you about A Small Favor. Can you explain a little bit about what A Small Favor is? Because aren't there three books in the Small Favor franchise? How does that work?
Okay, so right now there's two books. So the first one is called A Small Favor Volume 1, The Ruins of Enkidu 4. And that was our first book in the series, and now there's a new book called A Small Favor, Welcome to Earthworld, which is really a number zero issue. It's not as long as the first one because it's sort of intended as a new jumping on point for the story. We had an idea for a one-shot story, and we realized that it would be better as a number zero than a direct sequel. So yeah, that's the one that we just kickstarted. The first volume we kickstarted 2 years ago. And we started taking that to conventions last year, but we are currently working on volume 2, which we're going to bring to Kickstarter next year, which is just a continuation of the story.
Oh, cool. Okay. So what's the basic story in A Small World? What's the, you know, the premise behind all the storytelling?
Okay. So our series is about a character named James who's been alive for 1,000 years. Essentially, back in the Civil War, he realized he couldn't die. And then the main story takes place 1,000 years later in the distant future. And he's basically trying to solve the mystery of his own immortality with the help of an AI companion named Liz. And along the way, he has flashbacks to different times in his life. And the big sort of gimmick of our story is that every flashback is drawn by a different artist. So to date, we have had 16 different artists contribute to the book.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing because most people are really devoted to, say, one writer and one artist doing things. But you've made a whole franchise out of the fact that you use multiple artists, which in some ways I think that's a real benefit because... Let's say one artist gets wooed away and the person you're working with gets wooed away and goes, say, to Marvel or DC or something, and they can't turn that down. But what you have smaller chapters, different artists doing them. And I noticed you gave me number one to read, which I really liked. I thought that was a great story that you were doing that. And I didn't notice terribly amount of differences between the different chapters. Do you pick people based on that they can kind of be consistent from what you have already?
Kind of. What we mostly do, to be honest, is we just approach artists that we know, that we like, and then we try to find a story within our story that sort of fits their style. But yeah, I mean, we do have certain things that we look for, and, you know, we do have a certain sort of standard for our book, and so it's not all over the place. We're not going to hire a abstract painter for one story and then, you know, a classic Marvel artist for the next story. So there's a certain amount of consistency, but we've also made it important to the that we give the artist freedom to sort of interpret the characters the way they want to. And I think that's been a huge boon. I mean, absolutely some of the best stuff visually in the comic is stuff that the artist came up with that we, you know, we sort of had a basic idea for, and then they made it what it was. Mm-hmm.
Have you had that happen where somebody, a different artist brings a different thing and it sparks something in the story that you make a change because of what the artist did?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the artist who does the sort of main storyline in the book is a guy named Noah Meese, and he lives in New York, but he's not a comic book artist by trade. He's actually a prop designer on Broadway. And he kind of does art in his spare time. And he originally sort of designed the characters, the two main characters and a few other really important things in the book. But then we have definitely had contributions from other artists where they came up with things. Just in the new book, Welcome to Earthworld, our artist Kyle Serafolian, he's incredibly talented, and we had to introduce a few characters that were members of alien races that are going to be important later in the story. And he kind of made them his own. But now that's canon. So moving forward, his designs that he came up with are going to be what those aliens look like going forward, which is cool because he did a really good job, and he's very creative and yeah, I mean, probably cooler than what my co-writer and I would have come up with on our own.
I've heard of that in several circumstances where the artist throws something at the writer and the writer goes, wait a second, I never thought of that. I wish I had, you know, mm-hmm. kind of stuff, which is really cool. So the one that you had me take a look at was the volume one. And I really enjoyed that one. You do something interesting that not many comics can pull off successfully, and that's sort of time jump, depending on how the story goes. And sometimes what's happening in what looks to be the present has happened before in the past, and you get to see all kinds of interesting things, you know, that is going on with that. I really like the way it all comes together. It's not dense reading, but it's a challenge in the sense that it's not, you know, you don't have all kinds of things going on that you're juggling. It's that you're actually using the past sometimes to explain what's going on in the present or in the, and I like that kind of stuff. I enjoy, of course, I'm a big sci-fi guy, and that has something to do with it too. But I like the way that the story was told and the mysteries you have going on. I'm just kind of like, wow, I don't know what you're going to do. So, and I love when I don't know what you're going to do. I got so many people I can sit there and say, okay, here's where we do the, yeah, there it goes. And I get bored with that stuff. But with your books, I don't have any idea. And I like that. I think that you guys have put together a really interesting story that's really unlike anything I've ever read before. And I just have to congratulate you on that. That's just wow. You
know? Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we definitely in volume one, there's a lot of time jumping, and that's something we plan to continue with in volume two. But really our intention with the time jumps in volume one was that we wanted every flashback to demonstrate something about James's character mm-hmm. that was important in the sort of present day storyline. And so there is a big sort of important character that gets introduced in the second chapter, who's a sort of alien orphan boy who James meets on a planet that's been sort of ravaged by war. And then we see a flashback to the Civil War when he met another orphan boy during the Civil War who was just trying to, you know, find his place in the world, and seeing the differences in how they reacted, how James reacted to both of those situations. And hopefully, if we did our jobs right, that sort of informs the decisions he makes in the present day, dealing with meeting this new orphan. I mean, you know, you meet an orphan in the middle of a war zone, what do? You say, like, you know, get lost, you know, or do you help him out? That's just our attempt was to use those flashbacks to deepen the character, and hopefully we accomplished that. But definitely, I mean, this was the first comic book that I ever wrote, and I write it with my co-writer John Grimes, it was the first comic book we ever wrote. So I think that even just in that time, I mean, now we wrote this thing in 2016, so even since then, you know, we've learned a lot about storytelling, and I think that the new book, Welcome to Earthworld, which we did wrap up that Kickstarter last month, and we're going to have those books available online and in conventions starting in May. And hopefully, I think people will be able to see the improvement in our writing. And also, I think that this new story retroactively makes the first story better by deepening the world and sort of all the choices in it.
But you know what? Your writing is always going to advance if you're a good writer. I mean, you know, my favorite stories are the ones where I don't say, oh, that one was better written than the one before. my hope is that if it's so well written that it'll just carry the story forward, and you'll be able to, yeah, maybe from your perspective as the writer, you'll feel it's better. Those of us who are readers, you know, because the one that I, the volume one, I really enjoyed, I have to say.
Thank you.
You know, if you're going to do better than that, boy, I'm going to be really impressed, because that one was really good. I really enjoyed the volume one. I'm looking forward to zero and looking forward to what else you're going to do, because, you know, when you've got so many different story threads going along, you could still tie them all together into a cohesive unit. And if that's your first book, I don't know what you're going to do in about a couple of years from now. I'm going to be really interested to see what you can do, because out of the blue, I mean, this hit me really as something that was really strong. And
I just
your ability to coordinate artists and your ability to tell the story from different perspectives, I really liked that. I thought that was really a strong thing, because, you know, normally, you know, as much as I enjoy Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, when I would read Batman, it was almost always those two. And that's great. I mean, it's good to a degree. And you could see that they would do things a little differently as time went along, and they would take chances. But this one, I mean, you're juggling it. I was reminded very much of, you know, you ever see the jugglers who put plates on the top of sticks. Right. And they start to spin. And, you know, one of them starts to wobble. You got to run over and spin that one a little bit to keep it going. And I didn't get the sense that you had to do that, but I got the sense that you went from stick to stick, and just to tell different parts of the story, you would spin the plate a little faster at different times. So I was really impressed with how well this hung together. I really liked it.
Thank you. Working with my favorite part of creating the comic was working with all those different artists. Because when I started out, I was actually doing a little bit of comics journalism for a little, you know, one of those little rinky-dink websites that there's a million of, and I wasn't getting paid anything, but I was doing some interviews with just some different indie comics writers, and that gig didn't last very long, but I made a few friends, and I started to realize that I could I could do what they did. Mm-hmm. And so then I just started talking to people. And one of the first artists that I started working with was Walter Ossley, who I believe you know.
Yep. Shiver Bureau, all kinds. He's got a new book coming out called Metal Shark Bro.
Yep.
All kinds of stuff going on. Yeah, I know him. He's local here. I'm in Central Florida, and he's here in this area.
Yeah, and he was huge in terms of not only being willing to contribute art to the book. He did the cowboy story in the book, mm-hmm. but he also was just instrumental in, you know, giving me advice and helping us figure out the process of coordinating artists and a lot of the people that I ended up working with on the book were people that Walter recommended, because I would be like, okay, we've got this new story coming up. I need an artist that sort of has this kind of vibe. And I would send a message to Walter, and then half an hour later, he would send me six artists. He's like, you try these people. And then I would go talk to all those people and find someone that really fit what we were going for. So that kind of community too has over the years, over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, I've just met so many people, and they're all so ready to just help each other out, which is fantastic. So, you know, that becoming involved in that community of artists and writers online and everything, you know, not only did it help me make our comic, but also it's just a really great community to be a part of.
Now, see, you've touched on something that I found myself asking people more about recently. You said that you wrote reviews, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you realized you could tell stories just like some of the people whose books you were reviewing were like. See, I can't make that jump. That I can review, and I write reviews for Major Spoilers and stuff like that. And I can tell when something works, and I can tell something doesn't work. But that jump from reading somebody else's story and saying that works and actually coming up with the surprises myself is one I haven't been able to make, and I may never make, but I've just got it. It's a great thing. I always have to admire that in somebody who can, you know, suddenly realize, man, I could do that. I could tell stories by doing this and that and the other. And I'm just wondering, was it one experience that brought that to light for you, or was it just something that all of a sudden you realized, man, I would have done it this way, and that would have been better? Is that how did you make that leap?
Well, for me, I think it was that I've always wanted to tell stories. There was a time I went to film school when I was in college. I went to film school briefly before I ended up transferring to a different program. But I always was really into the idea of telling stories, and I have always read comics, and I had never thought about writing them. But once I started, what clicked for me was not reviewing mainstream comics. It was starting to talk to indie comic book creators, because those are the people who were the real inspiration to me, because what they were doing is so simple in terms of, you know, they had this idea, they drew their story, or they hired someone to draw their story, and they went to Kickstarter, you know, launch a project. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't have to have the backer of a publisher or a corporation or anything. I mean, it's like, if you have the story and you put it out there and other people like it and they resonate with it, mm-hmm. then you can make your thing and put it out into the world. So, I mean, I think for me, it was more of a epiphany in terms of the production side rather than the creative side. Hmm. Just the idea that I don't have to, you know, get a pitch accepted by Image Comics or something mm-hmm. to make a book. Mm-hmm. To be fair too, I was never much good as a comic book reviewer. I think that that's a whole different set of skills, that not everyone has. I think that, certainly I have much more found my niche as a writer rather than a critic.
Well, all I can say is that all I can do is respect that, because I'm kind of the opposite. I think I'm a good reviewer. Uh-huh. But when it comes to writing stories and like knowing when to do, see, I'm helping out with an indie book called Stabbity Bunny, and my roommate, Richard Rivera, is the writer of it. And I help him by editing, and I help him by, you know, helping him coordinate stuff, mm-hmm. and things like that. But I he asked me occasionally, does this work? And most of the time I can tell him, yeah, it's going to work. There was one time he was writing a book where he wanted something to be very funny, and he got down this whole page and he got to the bottom, and he said, well, does that pay off? And I said, well, not really. I said, it needs to be funnier. And he went back and rewrote it, made it funnier. Which, you know, to me is just like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
But it's kind of neat that I guess, you know, people always told me as a designer, I was never really going to be a high-end designer, although I can design ads and I do it for people and stuff like that. But it's probably the same thing with writer, and I'll probably stop asking that. But I'm always fascinated by the creative process, and I'm always interested in how people understand that they can write, where that happens, because it hasn't happened for me, but I guess it may never. But the good news is it happened for you, and it's got you writing, and that's the thing that I really like about it. I've got to ask you, because this story is so layered. I mean, as far as like developing that, did you have a lot of the layers in mind when the story started to come together? Did you have a more simple story and then realize that you could add elements to it? How did that happen as far as when you first came up with A Small Favor?
Well, the original idea was in a very simple kernel of, you know, a person who lives for 1,000 years, exactly 1,000 years, and sort of the idea of like, what would you do if you knew in advance that you were going to live for exactly 1,000 years? Not true immortality, but sort of like this really long life. And then from there, we came up with the core of his origin, which happens in volume 1, and then sort of what's happening in the modern day. We call it the modern day, the present day story. And from there, a lot of the other little stories were kind of developed as we wrote, and a lot of them were an extension of the character. Mm-hmm. Like, what did we want to say about the character? So there is a story where James has like joined up with sort of a space pirate crew, mm-hmm. and he kind of gets attacked by another crew, and then everyone dies, and he's on the ship, and he can't die, though. He's been exposed to the vacuum of space, but he can't die. Mm. Because he's, you know, his 1,000 years aren't up. And really, we wrote that story mm-hmm. purely to kind of teach the reader how his power worked. Mm. You know, so like that, I think there's levels of the stories, because there are certain stories that are very important, mm-hmm. That are critical to the whole ongoing story. And there's some that are less important. That story we will probably never revisit, because mm-hmm. it was purely to teach the reader something. Mm-hmm. But like the story that Walter Ossley did, mm-hmm. where he sort of goes out west after the Civil War, mm-hmm. that's the beginning of a very important story, which will be like considerably expanded on in volume 2. Mm-hmm. So we kind of have levels of importance in terms of, you know, there are going to be some stories that are sort of once and done, and they tell an important pivotal moment or an important like thing about the character. And then others that are part of the deeper, larger story. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we found a good balance there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, like I said, I like the balance between something happened in the past and something's happening currently. It's like, because his experiences are such that he realizes he's gone through something like this before.
Right.
And that kind of gives him some perspective on how to move in the present with stuff. So I really like that. I'm just fascinated by that. The whole concept of somebody that lives 1,000 years and knows it, I want to ask questions, but I don't want to know the answers. You know, I would like to know how does he know that? You know, and I'm sure this is part of the story that you're telling, and then there's this whole business about the old man that's just part of the story, and I have guesses on what I think is going on there, but I don't want to necessarily spoil or say anything, just on the odd chance that I'll be right on something. But I'm just fascinated. See, this is the thing that you're doing a good job of, is you're making me want to know what's going on. And so I have to keep reading to figure it out. I mean, there's all these little mysteries. Well, even like the AI. You know,
right.
How did she get involved with all this? And, you know, I always like the fact that when she speaks, it's in a box and the colors are reversed out. It's like a yellow box or an orange box. And the background's darker than the letters are, which is, makes her obviously different from what he's saying.
Right.
So there's all these little creative things that go into this book that make it really fun to read. And it's just an enjoyable thing, because oftentimes I've seen computers speak just like human beings, you know, same word balloons and stuff like
that. Right.
But it's nice to see somebody do something a little more creative with it, like you guys are doing.
Right. Well, thank you. I mean, everything you mentioned, I'm really glad that you said all the things you did, because all those things are things that we have written a lot more about, and more things will be revealed. Liz in our new book, Welcome to Earthworld, Liz has a much bigger role in the story. She's much more important. Mm-hmm. And in volume two, she becomes much more important. And like, as the story goes, you're going to start to see more and more her role in everything. And then the old man, of course, is sort of central to the whole mystery of the book. Mm-hmm. And we have... I won't spoil anything, but essentially we have a 3-volume arc where at the end of volume 3, you'll know who the old man is and sort of what's going on with him. You know, you're just going to have to kind of wait until then to find out. But I would love to hear fan theories. If anybody has a theory about what's going on. I've heard a few from some people that I met at shows who read the book, but nobody quite yet has hit the answer. Mm. But we had one person who was a big fan of the Highlander who had some complicated theories that were pretty much just taken from the Highlander. But and undeniably there is a little bit of an influence from the Highlander in our book. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely, the old man is not Sean Connery, I'll tell you that.
Okay, because that was kind of my guess. So I got, it was a good thing I didn't say that. So I would embarrass myself if that had been the case. But I see. But isn't that fun for you, though? You've got this thing figured out, and you've got, and people say this stuff and are trying to guess what it is you have in mind. I mean, as a writer, that must be fun, because that's what makes you a writer, and us readers, we're trying to guess what it is you got in mind. It's just a fascinating thing for me. I love it when I do that. I love when I can't figure it out, because, you know, I've gotten reasonably good at figuring out things in stories. So for me, this is a real challenge and real fun to do. So I just now I have to know. It's like,
so,
go ahead.
So I was going to say, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's a writer recently about big reveals in stories and mysteries. And a lot of times you'll be reading a book and there'll be a big reveal finally at the end of the book or the end of the trilogy or whatever. And you find out the secret, and sometimes it's satisfying, and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of how satisfying it is depends on how well the seeds were planted. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us right now, we're in this sort of limbo state where it's like there's sort of like there's an exciting mystery, but have we effectively planted the seeds so that when the mystery is revealed, you can say, oh, you know, like. That was what was going on the whole time. Because if it's just out of the blue, you know, like, oh, this is, you know, he was actually a magical dragon from another dimension. Like, that's not a super satisfying reveal.
No, I hate when people do that. It's like magic, you know, people use magic to do something to pull a rabbit out of their hat, kind of, you know, you're stuck in a situation that you haven't even address the possibility of getting out of, and suddenly they pull the magic wand out and poof, they're able to get out by something we've never heard of. I always am so disappointed when I read that. That is just the most disappointing thing in the world. I like it when you have the best thing in a story is when I can go back and reread it and say, okay, that's where they did that. Okay, now, yeah, I see that there. Yep, I get it. I like to do those kinds of things. Sometimes I can remember, but sometimes it takes me reading the thing over again for the second time once I know what's going on. So right. I like that. But that's the joy of reading, you know, and stuff like that. When somebody tells a good story, you are just... we used to watch Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and what we would always do is watch the episode once, and then the second time we would go through it just to see how did they accomplish what they did in that episode. Why did they make us care about such a character and stuff like that? So I've always been fascinated by that. And so your books are that way to me too. I'm dying to know what's going on here. That's the thing that's good story. Now, I do want to ask though, why is it called A Small Favor? I'm fascinated by that.
Okay. So, if you've read, the first volume, then you know when James first meets the old man and the old man saves his life, the old man tells him, you know, now you're going to live for exactly 1,000 years, but you're going to owe me a small favor. And so kind of, and the thing about the title is that when you read volume one, you don't get to that part until about 2/3 of the way through the book. And so, it's a little bit of, it's a little bit buried, but, essentially that's the core mystery of the book is what is this mysterious small favor that this old man wants, and why has he waited so long to come collect it?
That'll be fun. Yeah. I see the sequence, in the book, and I'm just, see, that stuff all gets me. I got to know that stuff now. So it's a good thing about that. So, okay. So where we stand right now is you've got the issue zero, I guess, and volume one.
Yep.
And volume two is the one you just did the Kickstarter for, right?
No, unfortunately, we're not that far along.
Okay.
We just did the Kickstarter for number zero.
Okay.
And volume two is in production right now, but we're not going to hit Kickstarter with it until next year.
Okay, gotcha.
Unfortunately, you know, we're still starting out, and, you know, I'm sure you know, comics are expensive to make. And so we're kind of slowly making it happen. Now we are starting to go to conventions and we're doing pretty well and we're starting to see people be interested in the book, which is really exciting and encouraging because of course for the first 3 years that we worked on this book, you know, we were just working on it by ourselves and we didn't, you know, nobody was seeing it. And so now that people have seen it and people are buying it, that's certainly encouraging and that's helping us, you know, financially get the project moving. But we're looking at next year, we're going to launch Kickstarter. But it should be, we did, for volume one, the book was only about a third finished when we launched Kickstarter. And so it took us about a year and a half to fulfill. For number zero, the book was almost done. So we are actually going to be hitting the print button next month. And for volume two, we plan on doing the same thing of having the book either completely finished or almost finished by the time we hit the Kickstarter launch, so that once it's over, we can get those books out to people as soon as possible.
Okay. Now the good news is I actually pledged to support you guys, and so I should be getting number zero.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to that one. I'm looking forward to getting that. So, see, all this stuff just fascinates me. I got to know.
Are you going to be at MegaCon Orlando?
Yes.
Fantastic. So we'll be there and hopefully we'll have number zero for that convention. It's going to be a little bit of a squeeze in terms of a time squeeze in terms of getting it printed and ready for that show. So hopefully we'll have it and so we can start getting that book out there because we actually really think of number zero as the jumping on point. So when new people come up and talk to us about the book, we're going to recommend that they read number zero first and then read volume one because volume one was, as you read it, it's a pretty slow burn. I think that is good if you're committed, if you're into it and you're going to read it. By the time you're finished, you know, I think it's a satisfying read. But what we did with number zero is we kind of gave more information quicker and it's a bit of a faster paced story. And it's sort of a you know, 101 introduction to the world and the universe. And but it's its own self-contained story, but it gives you everything you need to know to dive into volume one. And I think it makes the experience of reading volume one different. So I think people who read number zero first are going to have a little bit different experience reading it than people who read volume one first.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to have to buy paper copies from you because I order the digital stuff.
Okay.
See, I have three bookshelves that are pretty much full now. So I've been kind of doing the digital route, but I'm going to want paper copies of this one, I can tell. So when I see you, I'm going to have to do that. Did you do a Tampa convention?
I did. We met last year at Tampa Comic Con.
Yeah. The more I talk with you, the more I realize, yeah, I think I might have actually bought – you sold out there. And I think I might have bought one of the copies that you had there. So I have to dig through my stuff. My problem is my reading stack is like tall as I am now. And as I go to cons, I buy good things, and I don't get to them as fast as I need to. I bet you I have that one there. Oh, man, I'd like to go back and look that one up again. Because I remember I think you were just getting it out, I think, about the time that I was there, and you were in the process of selling out, so I quickly got one.
Right. Yeah. So we had done a print run last year with Kickstarter, and we had never printed a comic before, and so we didn't print a ton of copies. We printed about 200 copies, and Tampa was when we were running out. And so it was shortly after Tampa that we hit the button on a reprint.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have one of those rare first editions.
Oh boy, lucky me. I'm happy for that, and that's great, because I'm glad to hear you're doing so well, because I remember thinking this was a good idea and a good book, so I'm glad that things are taking off and picking up steam for you. Man, I'm dying to see, of course, one. So, okay, so volume two, and then you're going to do a volume three. You say you had three volumes in mind for this.
We have written three volumes, okay. And after that, we have some ideas, mm-hmm. but it kind of depends, and also we've had some discussions about how much stamina readers have in terms of a indie book, like for a purely indie book, do readers want to read, you know, nine volumes, or would they rather have like three volumes and then it's done? And we're not sure yet. So we're kind of, after we do volume three, which should be in a couple years, we're going to kind of take the temperature of our audience and see where everyone's at, because we have one possible ending to volume three that completely wraps everything up, and then another ending that kind of is like one of those teasers or the stinger at the end of the Marvel movie that's like mm-hmm. teasing what's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a matter of whether or not we think our audience would be interested in another three volumes.
Well, let me give you my input. If I can.
Sure.
If the story's good enough, I'm going to keep going. I don't know if you've ever heard, there's an indie book called Star Power.
Oh, yeah.
I was in Awesome Con last year, and I came across that book. They had three volumes out. I bought the three volumes, but I didn't get to read them until I was at a different convention, I think the week later. But I had taken them with me. And when I read the three, I was just like gripped. And so I immediately signed up for four. I got the fourth volume. They're working on, I think, number five right now. And I don't feel any less interest now than I did, because the stories, the quality of the storytelling is, you know, both artistically and in the writing area, is just as good as what got me attracted to it when I first saw it at Awesome Con. So I'm there. I mean, if they're going to do 20 of those volumes, I'll still be buying it, because I want to keep reading the story, because they tell really good stories. And I think with your book, I think that same thing. I think you've got a story that's unlike anything else out there. So I would say, take my opinion for what it's worth. It's just one person out there. But I would say, if you feel that the stories continue to be as good as when you started, and when people started to pay no attention to it, then I would say keep going.
All right.
It's my suggestion.
Well, right on. I actually met those guys, the Star Power guys, in, I think, 2012 maybe at Dragon Con.
Wow.
Or 2013.
Mm-hmm.
2014.
Mm-hmm.
2015. Sorry, I'm looking at a friend over here who I have no idea what year it was. I guess it was 2015.
Okay.
When they had the first volume. Mm-hmm. And they just had the first volume at Dragon Con.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it and I was definitely into it. And yeah, I've been following them. And you're right. I mean, it doesn't seem like they've had any drop off in audience in terms of people who are there supporting them and wanting to read the next thing. So, so yeah, I mean, that's definitely going forward. That's going to be kind of what we're looking at. As long as people keep wanting to read it, yep. We have more stories in mind.
Yeah. So. Well, I'll be there because I'm enjoying what you're doing, and I'd like to see a lot more of this universe that you've got set up. I mean, we're looking at it through one character's eyes. There must be other things going on in this universe. And again, there's this world-building thing that I'm big on. I if you want to drop something in the middle of the Marvel Universe, I mean, you've got a structure all in your place. But when you have to build your own structure, I just applaud that. I think that is, and the way you guys have set this up is really great. Someday I'm going to find out how old he is in certain places so we know how close to the 1,000 years we are. That's one thing. I'll sit down with the calculator and sit down and try to figure this out. So, but it's really a good story. It really is fun to read, and I think you guys do a great work with the art, and you have to give Walter a pat on the back for that. I mean, he's kind of your agent there in some ways, helping you find this stuff. Because I've interviewed him on this podcast as well. So.
Good
stuff. So I think A Small Favor is that wonderful thing. I can't wait to read the other stuff. I got to go digging through my books and try and find that original one, because now I want to save. I think you signed it for me, so I'm going to be. I might have to put that one in some place where I can keep that nice and fresh for a long time, because you never know. This could easily be a Netflix type story, and this could very easily be. HBO or somebody, because they have Westworld.
Right.
And I would say this could very easily follow along those lines and develop that kind of a following. So I think you guys are doing a great job. And, man, I want to see more Small Favors. And maybe the follow-up will be a Large Favor. And you'll develop things on from there. But, Caleb, I think you guys are doing good stuff. And, boy, I'm along for the ride. So I'm anxious to see what's coming up next. And I'm gonna make sure I follow you on Kickstarter and keep this stuff going, because it's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Tom Saki, the co-creator of a wonderful series called Offbeats, and also the creator, I think, writer for Ultrabot Go Go Go. So how are you doing today, Tom?
I'm doing great. How are you, Wayne?
Good. Good to talk with you. You got some projects in the works that we just mentioned here. Why don't we get started? Well, why don't we start talking about how you got interested in doing comics? You sent me a little biographical information, and I got some found interesting that you're a Spider-Man guy, it looks like. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I was a kid growing up in the early 70s, I remember seeing comic books when I was a kid, like a little boy, like on those spinner racks.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, I really didn't like them. I found the colors to be like too bright, and it just kind of looked funny to me. I was really more into like Godzilla films and like monster movies and things like that. But I always loved the animated cartoons. When I was a kid, all the stuff that was in like syndication, like Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner and Woody Woodpecker and Tom and Jerry, and Pink Panther. And they started syndicating that early, I think it's like the first ever animated Spider-Man series that was done in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But I started seeing like repeats in like around like the bicentennial.
Mm-hmm.
when I was a kid. And yeah, I just loved it. I was like, oh, this is like so cool. It was like a whole new world for me. And I was very fortunate because I grew up in Brooklyn, and it had to be at the time probably one of like the country's first like it was like a comic book slash like magazine shop. Like they would have like all tons of back issues of comic books and like science fiction magazines and even like odd stuff like Life and things like that, and like Life magazine and Look magazine. And it was great. It was walkable, and my mom, you know, when I was younger, my mom drove me there for the first time. I bought all these like back issues of Spider-Man, and pretty much I was dyslexic as a kid, so I couldn't really read well. So eventually I figured out, oh, like, you know, you put these panels together and then there's these words, and I learned how to read through comic books. And so pretty much all throughout my youth, I was reading those superhero books, but I started getting bored with them like around like the end of junior high and into high school. And I was really fortunate because in the 80s, you had that whole independent wave, like an independent boom of all these companies are coming out, like Pacific Comics, which later became Eclipse, First Comics, Comico. So I was buying a lot of stuff from those guys, and I was really loving, and it's funny because I always felt black and white books were kind of undone. Like they weren't colored, so I wouldn't look at them. They're like, yeah, it's not finished, which is kind of funny now because now I'm the opposite. I prefer actually a black and white book. But I really started really getting into Stan Sakai's Usagi Yojimbo. That was a really big influence. I was like, wow, this is incredible. And I started getting a subscription to Heavy Metal magazine. So I really loved the European stuff, like Mobius. And you couldn't really find it anywhere. You had to go through, like, that magazine was, like, the only source for, like, European stuff. And in there I discovered an amazing Belgian artist who unfortunately passed at a very young age in a car accident. I think he was, like, under 30. I think he was, like, 28 years old. His name is... my French isn't great, but his name, I believe, is, I don't know, it's like Yves okay. Chalon. And he created a book called Freddie Lombard. And I remember looking at that and I was like, ah, oh, this is weird. It's like, it's not like the other stuff that's in Heavy Metal where it's all rendered and quite detailed. There was this very like animated style. Like it looked like it came from like an animated cartoon. It was really like simple and bold shapes against very... clear line backgrounds, again, with like flat colors, like all the coloring is flat and bold. But then when you actually looked at it, there was some really great things going on, like really great acting and just a simplicity to it where things were very clear in the storytelling. And that led me like on a lifelong path of like discovering Franco-Belgian comics, as they say, you know, European stuff. And yeah, with Offbeats, what I'm trying to do is create a, basically like a crime noir, like a things that are influenced by me. Like I love mid-century America. I'm from New York, and create this kind of like a crime noir story, but the visual is cartoony, but the actions and the things that people do and say are very adult, and the Europeans have been doing that for quite a while, and trying to tap into that.
Well, that's good. Okay, now you mentioned Offbeats, and that's the book that's when this post is already out there. Offbeats number one.
Yeah, it just came out this Wednesday, and the second issue should be out in about like 3 weeks. So,
Now, let me ask you. Of course, why don't you tell what the story's about a little bit?
It's kind of my elevator pitch is it's this mid-century kinetic crime war on a Belgian comics tip. And it's kind of like those elevated pictures when they combine like two properties. It's like Sin City meets Tintin, or a gritty Archie comic, if you can believe that. And that's what I was going for visually. The story is about like this young, it's the era of the beatniks. And this young kind of like dreamer slash trouble magnet, his name is Jim Rhodes, and he's from Pittsburgh. And the story alludes to the fact that he's coming to New York to be a writer. And there's also also he was kind of in some trouble, which I don't want to explain, give all the spoilers away, mm-hmm, but it's told in flashbacks even throughout the whole series. Even the first issue, you can see he was involved in some pretty serious events, mm-hmm, let's say, of a criminal nature. Mm-hmm. And he comes to New York, and he's immediately thrust into, again, like a very troublesome situation with a street gang. Mm-hmm. And he's immediately saved by another young street hustler slash jazz man, mm-hmm, named Booker Brown from Harlem. And they immediately become like bonded, and they go on quite this little adventure throughout the book with a combination of gangsters, the mob, and also a corrupt police force. So it's kind of an interesting take, and it sounds complex in a way, the way I explain it, but what I was going for is with comic books, I really love comic books that move, that, mm-hmm, are very kinetic, mm-hmm, that have a clarity to them. I really love terse dialogue, and the art stands head and shoulders on top of that. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm trying to go for with all my projects, and I got going in the works, that, mm-hmm, kind of through line that is comics that move, comics that are immediately accessible and have an ease to them when you read them. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like my mantra. Yeah.
Now, how many issues? This is a mini series, I understand. So
it's a mini series. It's four issues. So it's like pretty much a complete story. There is I don't want to give too much away either, but you know, obviously open to possible future story arcs. But in general, it's a complete story once it's done.
Now you're listed as one of the creators with John Ward,
yes,
and the writer is John Ward.
Do you have, yes, yeah.
And I noticed a lot of the stuff that you guys have done, you do those things together. Is he kind of like your co-creator kind of thing? How's that work?
So I'm kind of approaching the idea. I always wanted to do a comic book since I was like about 20 years old, and it was a very vague idea. It was like, yeah, like, you know, like any guy who's really interested in like film or books or whatever, I want to write or whatever, but I had absolutely no inkling of how comic books were even created when I was 20 years old, and I can't draw from my life dependent on it. I always wanted to figure out, I always thought I'd try to draw one, let alone even write one, since I don't even want to write, and I don't enjoy writing, actually. So I would say around like 2010, I really got the inkling to really do my own book. I was reaching, my half-life, my midlife. Mm-hmm. I knew that was coming up. And I really, you know, it was always a dream at that point to really do my own book in my 30s. I really wanted to do one. So mm-hmm. I started listening to this really great, it's two things, actually. First up is I'm a former computer animator. I'm one of North America's first computer animators. And I got an opportunity to work on a fully computer animated TV series in the late 90s up in Toronto, Canada. And I became really good friends with a comic book publisher up there at the time. His name is, he's like my best friend. He's like a brother to me. His name is Kaja Blackley. Mm-hmm. And he had a really unique publishing venture going down in the around 94, 95 called Mad Monkey Press. And he was very much influenced by, again, European comics. And he was doing some really, really visually doing some really amazing things. No superhero books. All his books were oversized, 8x10 at least. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his stuff was his own content. He was writing it, but he was an artist himself. He can draw, but he had so many concepts and ideas he needed to get out. So he had like about four or five different titles. Only one he drew. The rest were, his concepts and scripts, and he would, contract artists to draw the books. So that gave me kind of an idea of like how they're created. He gave me like a really great insight to that. Mm-hmm. And around 2010, I was listening to this amazing podcast called The Process, mm-hmm, and had three podcasters on it, three up and coming at the time, they were up and coming comic book creators, writers. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Holt was one, and Curtis Weave is the other, and I can't think of the other guy at this moment. I'm sorry about that. He's an Australian creator. And they all made it. They're all actually, you know, in the industry doing quite well, thriving. And at the time, they were just really talking about how they put together a pitch, how to submit a pitch, what you do when you get your rejections, and if you ever hear anything. And as I'm listening to this, they're just giving me these golden nuggets of how to put a comic book together. And I was like, huh. I'm like, well, I worked in the animation biz, and I've seen... I've never worked as a producer personally, but I've been around animation producers, and most of them don't, you know, they don't even come from an animation background, and yet they're, you know, putting, you know, basically, you know, putting together this stuff. And by listening to that podcast, I was like, huh, let me really, really think this out. I said, you know what? What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the role as actually a producer, like someone who produced a film or a play or whatever. And, I'm going to hook up with a great writer. So I went on a little bit of a search for a writer, and found one in John Ward, who's just amazing. He's fantastic. He's a screenplay writer. He's a British Canadian out of Vancouver. And yeah, really interesting. I have a whole international team. It's interesting. I put together my comics due to the internet, right? You couldn't do this 20 years ago or 30 years ago. You have to use pen pals or something. You have to be all local. And I said, look, I go, would you be interested in doing a sweat equity kind of deal and shared IP? And he was like, yes. And I basically just gave him, like, with offbeats, I just gave him an idea. I'm like, look, I definitely want to do something that is like kinetic, that move, like, you know, that really moves. It takes place in mid-century New York City, and it's got a really crime noir kind of feel to it. And I said, the main thrust of it is I gave him the character of Jim Rhodes, and that he was a writer from Pittsburgh, wannabe writer, like wannabe beatnik. You know, so he's influenced by Jack Kerouac and all that whole beatnik scene, poetry and whatnot. And that was really about it. And then he basically came back to me with log line and outline, really like an outline. And he really created all the supplemental characters of Booker Brown, where he's from, Lynn from Chinatown, Lynn, Booker Brown's sister, and some of the other additional characters. So he really created. So then he would break down the first script, the events, really kind of like that Stan Lee style. And I would look at it and just really give a couple of notes. But pretty much I gave John carte blanche. I was like, yeah, this is great. And once he came back to me with the full script, it was pretty much gangbusters from there. Excuse me. And from that point, then I went on a search. So that's so John is really the writer. I can't really talk about his process because I don't write, you know. So it was a wonderful thing where I get his scripts. I love it in a way. I think this is a great way to get a comic out if you're not a writer but you have ideas. So it was great when I would get his script. It was like me reading the comic for the first time. So it's a very cool feeling. I enjoy it. You just have to give a lot of freedom and liberties to your writer. But if you're open to that, to have your idea to be basically, it's like your baby, and you give it away, and it's nurtured and it comes back. It's quite amazing. So and then on that note, I personally then become the art director, because I do have the vision. I am a former animator. I know what I like visually. I know what I want. And I was able to acquire a great artist named Giles Crawford, and he's an Australian American. And he's just amazing. He loves Tintin. I found his stuff via another artist friend on Facebook, and I was looking at his stuff, and I'm like, oh, this kid's born to draw this stuff. For offbeats, and I pitched him the idea, and I said, "Look, I could pay you this page rate," and he was all in, and he was fantastic. He did each issue on a Cintiq that was like a small one, so because he has this really strong storyboarding, story art background as an animator, so he was able to combine the Tintin kind of Belgian comic style with this also this very animated very animation storyboard style. And I gave him I said, look, I want lots of wide panels, very cinematic. I want this thing to move. And he got it all. And I said, look, it's all, I made it a little easy on him because it was really like his first big comic. I said, look, it's all going to be against black. So you have to really draw the city. You know, New York City is such a detailed place. Mm-hmm. I said, I just want the impressions of New York or a big city. Mm-hmm. And he did it in spades. So, yeah, it was great. He's fantastic to work with. He was able to, he basically thumbed and penciled inked all four issues in about maybe 8.5, 9 months, if that, maybe less, about 8 months, mm-hmm. which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Now, yeah. I've got to ask, who's your publisher? I mean, as far as that goes, if somebody wants to get it.
It's, yeah, so because Offbeats was really created by 2013, the whole book was penciled and inked, mm-hmm. and by 2014, it was all colored. So it took a long time, obviously tons of rejection, but an editor from the small publisher called Guardian Night Studios, which is in a, which has a kind of like a piggyback printing deal with Antarctic Press. Mm-hmm. He approached me. His name is Austin Rogers, the editor, my editor. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at pages at the very beginning when I was posting them on Facebook. And I said, yeah, it's pretty much ready to go. And he approached me about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very fortunate to get a publisher. And then all the marketing and promotion is pretty much on my end. You know, mm-hmm. it's I'm doing all the heavy lifting, but I was fine with that. I just wanted a publisher to champion my work, mm-hmm. and to get it out there. And then I would do the rest, and I'm fine with that. So feel very, very fortunate to have even a small publisher get this stuff out.
Now, is this available like through Diamond?
Yes, it's okay. Through Diamond. It's through Antarctic Press. It's, mm-hmm. So it's all through Diamond. If you go to my websites, my social media links, like on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, I always list the Diamond order codes and also in the promo ads I created. So, and we had quite a nice, we had close to 1,200 copies, pre-orders for the first issue.
Good.
Which is quite high for an indie. Yeah,
yeah, that's
for
good.
For the unknown. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I will recommend this. If you are going to take the method that I went, the route that I went, if you actually truly want to create a comic book, I'm not really a fan of the idea of pitches. I think what one should do is maybe take those 4 or 5 or 6 or how many ideas that you have for a story and really think about the one that really like lingers and sticks with you and the one that you think about the most. Mm-hmm. And that's the one really you should try to make an actual full book, at least one issue, mm-hmm. with, to show that you have the capability of doing it. Like, pitches are cool, but they're only like 3 to 6 pages. Mm-hmm. And you don't know, like, it's also slightly ambiguous because you're like, you're basically, it's like just like a trailer. Mm-hmm. But they actually create a book with, you know, full 22 pages in color with covers. To show that to a publisher, I think it has more gravitas. Like, it actually, mm-hmm. shows you, oh, you can do this. Mm-hmm. And you can obviously, you know, or if a publisher's insistent on using pitch pages, you can just take the best pages out of that first issue, those, you know, 4, 5, or 6, and use that as a pitch. Mm-hmm. And you should also always think about the marketing, how you're going to market and brand this product. Mm-hmm. I always looked at, like, Image Comics as really, like, you know, their promotions and marketing for the comics is phenomenal, I think. Mm-hmm. So I basically replicated my promos and ads like an Image Comic. So when you look at it, it's like, oh, this looks like something I know. Like, mm-hmm. this looks like a true premium product, you know, mm-hmm. As a comic. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
See, that's a great way to go about it. I tell the story here on occasion on the podcast. I'm an, mm-hmm. editor for an indie comic. It's called It's called Stabbity Bunny, and
yeah, I know of it. Yeah,
because what happened was that Richard Rivera, who's the writer and the creator of it, he got 6 issues done, and they put it out into a hardcover, and started showing it to people. We went to a lot of cons and sold sold them there at the conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a lot of attention, and people started to pay attention. And then it was picked up by Scout Comics. They saw mm-hmm. some of the stuff that we were doing. And the mm-hmm. first issue just skyrocketed. You know, we couldn't keep it in track, you know, keep track of it, because, you know, Diamond had trouble getting everybody the orders that they ordered for some reason. And mm-hmm. of course, that made yeah. all the collectors went nuts. Oh my gosh, this is hard to get. And so they went crazy.
It became like a hard to find thing, which it had the momentum, but yeah. it was hard to get.
Yeah, and of course that got the collectors involved, and it really mm-hmm. helped, you know, get the word out on the book, because we would go like to different cities for cons and sell the stuff.
Uh-huh.
People would, we were sitting in, for example, I'll give you a real quick story. We were sitting in Seattle at Emerald City Comic Con.
Uh-huh.
We were up on the top level where Artist Alley is, this sixth floors to this building where they are. And yeah. Rick was there signing some books for somebody. And, you know, people were passing by, and all of a sudden this one guy stopped and his head spun around. He goes, he says, "Is that Stabbity Bunny? Oh my gosh, I got to get some of those." So we had to stop what we were doing so we could sell him. Because out of the blue, he saw it and recognized it and stuff. So, you know, I think the social media stuff that you're doing is wonderfully wise, because that's how a lot of things now is, the word gets out these days.
It's like 30 years ago, how would you advertise a comic? You know, mm-hmm. it's a completely different paradigm now. So, mm-hmm. and it's social media is free. Mm-hmm. So that's the great thing about it. It's like, you know, so it's not like, the, you know, like in the past you'd have to do trade ads or something like that, like, you know, to get it out, and
ash cans.
So you know, it's a completely different thing. I was completely unaware of all that stuff when I was younger, but mm-hmm. yeah, it's interesting times have changed, but yeah, you know, that's the medium now to get the word out. So
see, the thing that's wonderful to me is you get to tell the story, and you know, if it hadn't been for the era that you're now doing this in, we might never get to read the story, because
If it wasn't, like,
if it was DC or Marvel, if DC or Marvel didn't do it, you didn't get to see it. But now you get to do your own, and we get to read the story, which I enjoyed, by the way. You made issues 1 through 4 available for me to look at, which I really enjoyed the read. It was a great read. So
thank you.
So I just see that it's such a wonderful time for storytellers like you, who can get the word out and get, you know, and people can look around and
actually
find
get the talent to and get the talent to put it together. It's like indie comics exists 30 years ago, or mm-hmm. like almost really 40 years ago. You know, by the early 80s it starts happening, but like 30 years ago, it's 1988, it's 1989. Mm-hmm. I'd have to do it really locally, and I have to find someone, and it would have to be local talent, and it would be completely it's a completely different thing. Now it's like, it's wonderful. It's just, you can reach out with Facebook. Well, I'm a Facebook aficionado, so, mm-hmm. but because it was the first one. Well, really MySpace was, whatever. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and, you know, to look for artists and, you know, get the word out and befriend artists. And it's just unique. It's a unique way. Mm-hmm. I'm instantly, it's actually the con, it truly is the true con of social media. Like, you know, there's pros and cons or negatives, but the true con is to interact with, you know, this whole community of comic book creators and artists and whatnot. So it's wonderful.
Yeah, because it's like Stabbity Bunny, the writer lives in Florida. The artist lives on the top of a mountain in North Carolina.
Yeah, and he does, right? Yeah.
And then the colorist lives in the Philippines.
Yeah, my colorist, I forgot where Dan Thompson, he colored the first 3 issues. I forgot where he is. He's somewhere in the Midwest, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the colorist I'm working with now is Lee. I can never pronounce his last name. It's like Miller Whiskey, I think it's mm-hmm. pronounced. And he's down in Florida. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Down in like near Miami, I believe, or Orlando. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's wild stuff. Yeah.
But they've never been in the same room together, the three.
No, none of these guys. I spoke to John Ward, my writer, I think, twice.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to Giles, I think, once.
Mm-hmm.
And with my I don't think I ever spoke to Lee on the phone at all. And with my new, I have a one shot coming out in May that I'd like to talk about. The artist of that, we never spoke until very recently. Like until I, basically I was telling, I had really good news for him. I'm like, yeah, Ultrabot's going to get printed. So yeah, pretty exciting.
Now, I have one more question, then we'll move on to that other book.
Yeah,
why is it called Offbeats?
Well. It's interesting. I had a lot of names for it. One of those things where you had like three or four names. I think Offbeats works because of the Beatnik generation.
Right.
And they're somewhat, if the characters are a bit, they're not the the establishment of the time. They're not the status quo. So, you know, like Jim is, you know, obviously a blue collar guy coming from, you know, he's a former mechanic. That's really his job in Pittsburgh, but you know, obviously he wants to be a writer and you know, dreamer, and Booker Brown is you know, a small time hustler from Harlem, but actually is quite talented. He's quite the horn player, and so yeah, you have like these you know, on the fringes of society of that era. So that's where really the name comes from. And I was also looking for comics that didn't have that name. You know, I had a bunch of other names. A lot of the comics had those names attached. So people finding, I couldn't find a comic with the name Offbeat. So it worked. So that was also the other.
Because I'm familiar with music, does the term downbeat. I don't know. Is there?
Exactly. I was considering that too.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Downbeat,
but it sounded a little too depressing. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I like that, like, you know, off kilter, offbeat, you know, on an offbeat.
Very good.
Yeah, has a jazz connotation as well.
So, and I enjoyed the story. Like I said, I pacing was good. Characters were really strong. You do some stuff in there that makes this not a all ages comic, shall we say?
Yeah, it's not an all ages comic. No, it's definitely almost a hard R.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, but it's not for kids. No. Though it looks it. But that is the, if you actually look at European comics, it's wonderful. Like the Belgian stuff, they'll have these really like cartoony characters, but the situations and things that they're doing are not, they're adults. So, you know, I love that contrast.
I think that gives you the chance to have a wider, I don't know how to say it, a wider scope. You know, if you do something silly, you can do that in the artwork, but you can also do serious, which is something I really
like. It gives it just this off kilter kind of thing. It's like, wow, what? Because, you know, there's so many, you know, crime noir, crime comics. It's not a new thing. It's been around since the 40s, 50s. And, but there's usually always like a huge element artistically of realism attached to it. And I didn't tell John the art style in the very beginning. I just gave him I gave him a bunch of comics that I loved. Like, look, this is what I'm going for, you know, in terms of style and writing and pacing. And he got that immediately. He's like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing. And so it's another good thing. If you're working with a writer, if you're like going to come from a production angle, give your writer the comics that you love. Like, get copies, you know, extras, and give them to him, and say, this is what I'm going for writing-wise.
Right.
So, Then I explained to him, we initially put a little pitch together, but then I was like, pitches are kind of, like I said, I think they're, if you have a really strong idea, then you should actually create a full issue. So, but when we initially put the pitch together, I said, yeah, it's going to look like a Tintin comic. He's like, what? Cause he's British. So he's familiar with them. He grew up with them. And he's like, really? I go, yeah, it's gonna look like a Tintin or Asterix comic. He was like, really? And he was like, okay. And then when I sent him the first pictures of the script, I mean, from the pitch, he was like, wow, he goes, this is amazing. And he goes, yeah, this is really cool because it goes against the tropes of what a crime noir comic could be.
Very good. Let's move on to the other book. Now, you said Ultrabot Go, 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 which of course is reminiscent of Power Rangers, Transformers.
Not Power Rangers.
Well, the Go.
No.
No?
It's really reminiscent of mid-century, early 60s Japanese manga, Japanese comics. So things like Gigantor, Astro Boy, Speed Racer, Giant Robo. That's my other huge influence. I'm fortunate in New York City about a little over, maybe, quite a while ago now, like maybe almost 20 years ago, they opened up a Japanese comic book shop in the, like, a little Japan section of New York. And I was flabbergasted by it. I was like, holy cow. I was like, you know, it's all used. It was all used Japanese comics. Some of them, they had a whole dollar rack. And I've always wanted to get my hands on, I always admired Tezuka's stuff, and none of it really translated. I always knew his stuff, you know, the creative Astro Boy. And they had tons of his stuff for like a buck, because it wasn't as popular, you know, way it was back in the day. And from then on, I discovered like what I call Tezuka's children. It's like all these artists were all influenced by Tezuka's style, all in the late 50s and all throughout the 60s. And like those books I mentioned, like Gigantor, Speed Racer, those are really what the Americans know. There are tons of other stuff from these other artists like Mitsuru Yokoyama, who created Giant Robo and Gigantor, and Cyborg 009, created by, what's his name? Ishinori, I always forget his name. But Ishinori, something like that. But anyway, from looking at these books, I can't read a word of Japanese, like I can't read a word of French. And these books read right to left, but there's such a clarity and energy to these books that were created now 60 years ago. And I was completely floored by this. I'm like, I could look at pretty much any of these books from this era and understand the story completely without reading a word. You know, there's always those nuances when usually the quieter scenes when the characters are talking, there's not very many of them. But other than that, the whole story is told completely visually. And I've never really seen I've seen comics that emulate manga, but it's contemporary manga. I've never seen one emulate, not even just in terms of character styling, which Ultrabot Go 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 does, but in terms of actually the page layouts and pacing, I've never seen it done before. And it's a pretty amazing book. It's 22 pages. It's a one shot. And it's pretty much, I think it's the most action packed 22 pages you'll ever read. If you've ever read. The story. Yeah. I was saying, if you want to know about the story.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's just, it's kind of like, it's actually the first comic book idea I ever got, thought about. And because I really want to do an homage to a love letter to these Japanese comics of this era. And it's kind of like influenced by like things like Frankenstein and RoboCop and things like that, where it's just like it's this like secret operative for like, you know, a world government that is against a rogue terrorist organization called Shimitar that, of course, you know, wants world domination. And, you know, he's a secret agent named Kip Fenwick. And he enters like the lair of, one of the, top Shimitar agents, and is unfortunately quickly, how can I say this? He's completely disintegrated by like an energy ray. And the next thing you know, he's then reintegrated, you know, and the story cuts immediately. And he's reintegrated into this giant robot that this world government created called Ultrabot. And of course, he's, you know, Kip Fenwick's essence is in this giant robot, not to his liking, and you know, and has to go on a quest to destroy, you know, pretty much the world's giant enemies and foes and things like that, you know, like giant monsters and other robots. So it's like a complete homage to all that stuff that was huge in the early 60s in Japan. So it's a really fun book.
There's a nice surprise as to who's doing what, you know, who the bad guy is.
We want to give a little, you know, it looks like a book of that era, but we also gave it some contemporary, touches and, you know, some little, you know, like mystery in the story. You just want to be not so straight ahead where it's just him fighting giant monsters and little like subplots in there and things like that. So,
and there's an interesting twist in the setup as you get to the end, which I won't spoil here, but let's just say that things don't end up the way they start. Why don't we say that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The whole book starts out that way.
Which is kind of fun. There's lots of action, lots of adventure involved. And it's a, a word we never get to say much in comics anymore. We're so busy worrying about feelings and stuff. It's nice to see an adventure comic like this.
Yeah, I really wanted to create, like, you know, I really love, like they say now, the comics medium is the writer's medium. Like, you know, it used to be the artist medium for quite a while, but now it's the writer's medium. I'm finding a lot of contemporary comics of the last, like, 20 years, really, that the writers are trying, basically, all right, they say you can do anything in comics. Like, everyone says that about their medium, right? I can do this with music, I can do some writing. But actually, in reality, every medium has its constraints and, you know, it has its limitations. Mm-hmm. And you have to work within those limitations. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have one page, you can only have so many panels, really, until it breaks apart. And you really, your goal is that on that page, each panel should really tell the story to its ultimately to its conclusion. The panel should carry the story. And I find a lot of writers today, they're filling up. They're like, oh, okay, I only got 22 pages. So I got to fill up almost every panel with words, with my dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I love, like, with offbeats and especially with Ultra Bach Go Go Go, there's these pages of you get some breath, like, okay, not every panel has words in it. Like, oh, you can see this. It really literally moves like cinema, like the idea of storyboards. I'm really trying to convey that idea. And also things like a directional thrust. Like a lot of comics today, like, you know, it's all about the camera angles, getting really into, like, you know, really tight close-ups. Mm-hmm. I'm more about setting up the establishing shots and, you know, really getting an openness to it, like a directional thrust, a kineticism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some comics have been doing it really, but we're just catching up now to what the Japanese were doing 60 years ago. It's wild. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were so ahead of their time, you know.
Yeah, so, I got into some anime, like Akira.
My first, like in the late 80s, all this stuff started coming out. And I was like, you know, people talking about Watchmen. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of like hacked to me. I'm like, I'm reading Akira, Area 88. Pineapple Army, all these first, you know, it was 80, you know, it was 80s manga at the time, but still, it still moved. There was nothing like it. Mm-hmm. And that always left an impression on me, a strong one. So, so I went to do again, like, but I went back and then I really found the source of it. It all comes from the 50s and 60s. It's where it really all starts. Wow. How they're trying to figure out stuff. It's only really a handful of artists. It's not really a lot of guys. And, they're all self-taught. So they may lack in strong artistic skills. They don't really care. They just do it their way. It's all about moving the story. Yeah, it's really unique time.
Very cool. Yeah. Now, of course, you said Ultrabot Go 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 is coming out, what, May?
It's coming out, May 29th. Around Memorial Day weekend. Hopefully, you know, hopefully it's not late because it's done. It's a one shot, but me and the team, because John Ward is the writer, by the way. So it's the same, you know, John Ward is my man. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to really work with anyone else. The artist of it is Jason Williams, who is incredible. Like I said, this is my first ever comic book idea, but I really needed to find a really great artist who had the cartooning, the animated cartooning chops. Mm-hmm. I found him on Facebook, and he was doing this wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. These great homages to all this, like, Cartoon Network stuff and Nickelodeon. And he did his own, like, comic book pitch for Inspector Gadget, like his own kind of take on it. And I was looking at this stuff, like, wow, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he was looking for work. And I said, would you want to do a comic? Because I'm dying to do one. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you familiar with, like, 1960s manga? And he was like, just other than Astro Boy, wasn't really good familiar with it. Mm-hmm. I said, look, I'm trying to do this, this homage to that. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I'm down. He goes, you know, I want to try it out. And I basically, again, I forwarded him, I gifted him a bunch of my favorite Japanese books, my manga books from that era. And he went gangbusters with it. It took him a little while to get it because he's not his inclination to draw in that style. Mm-hmm. But he got it. He aced it, man. And not just the visually, the character design, but the whole pacing of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And this book has, like, sometimes 9 or 10 panels. And each page, but it moves. And he was able to do it via John's script. And even John, to write it, it was quite a challenge for him. But he was able to do it. It's such a terse, the writing is so terse, but, you know, so he had to try to bridge the gap, you know, try to find a balance, and he really did. So the goal is to get a Kickstarter going. We're hopefully going to do a 4-issue mini of Ultrabot Go Go Go. Hopefully it'll be out in early 2020. We're going to do a Kickstarter per issue. Just really like a low introduction, like maybe like a little over $2,000 an issue, maybe like $220. And that's really just going to my artists and my colorists. We're going to try to do it at 34 pages per issue to really give it the breadth and scope of what a manga, because that's the benefit of manga. Like, you know, they're not locked into a 22 page format. They do it in chapters. Most of their chapters are about 30 pages. So, between 30 and 40. So we're going to try to go in that direction. And, John is working on the script now via a lot of my ideas, but, he's taking it, going off with it, going to places with it. So, for the first issue. So I'm pretty excited by that. I'm trying to get some momentum. I hope hope it comes into fruition.
Yeah, when are you going to do the Kickstarter? Do you know?
Probably around the time that that Ultrabot comes out. So I'm thinking like maybe mid-May to mid-June. Yeah, like right around the time it's going to come out, or right after. Yeah. So there's momentum behind it.
Because right now there's a lot of Kickstarter seems to be going on. So it might be good to wait a little bit until some of those wrap up and then go do
exactly.
Yours.
You know. Yeah, and like I said, I'm trying to do I'm not asking for a huge amount of money. Obviously, if we get more money, then it just goes into the further development of the 4-issue mini. So, yeah, if it's like $2,000, I get $6,000, and pretty much pays for it. So I love that. But
that's cool.
We'll see how it goes. Yeah.
Well, I got to ask you something, just because I got to know why things are the way they are. On the inside cover, where the credits are, behind Ultrabot Go 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 and the names of you guys, there's a number 5. Why is there number 5 back there?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. Thanks for asking. So, yeah, the Ultrabot Go Go Go. It's kind of like a play on the words of, like, you know, a go go, like that. You know, you've heard that before. But actually, Speed Racer in Japan is called Mach Go Go Go, which is Mach 555. It's like that the car is the Mach 5. And Ultrabot Go Go Go, and this is actually, I don't want to get into it too much, but actually this is a big part of the actual mini, if it, like, again, if it comes into fruition, is that Ultrabot, this Ultrabot is actually an iteration of 5 before it. And I'll leave it at that. It's a little mystery.
Actually
noticing that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's all kinds of possibilities.
It's an homage to Speed Racer, you know, again, homage to the Japanese comics, of mid-century comics that I love. And homage to, it's a little, then we put it into a story, kind of, so it works. It's actually a little 5 on his chest.
Yeah, oh, is that,
on his chest plate.
Oh, I don't see it on there, but.
Pretty sure.
Is it belt? Yeah. Is it in his belt? Is that where it is?
Oh, in his belt, excuse me.
It's in his belt.
Yeah, in his belt.
I didn't notice that.
Separates the torso.
Okay,
I didn't notice. A little 5 there, yeah.
That's cool. So it's very interesting. So. The things to do, it's when it comes to Ultrabot Go Go Go, and the other book Offbeats. That's right. Just skips my mind there for a second. lots to remember. Go to your comic store and let them know that you're interested in these books. Are they in under Antarctica in the?
They're both under Antarctica.
Okay.
Yeah, they're the publisher, and try to, go. I know, look, like, there's only, I live in Manhattan now. There's only, like, 4 comic book stores left. And three, and out of the 3, it's a franchise. It's a monopoly.
Oh.
A great one, though, called Midtown. I love it. They're the best. But, I know. So, find a comic shop by you, if you live near one, and see if they can order it if they don't have it. I don't know what the deal with Diamond with back orders are, how that works, but
Ben, if they've got them in stock, they'll put them out. Now, what about, are you going to do Offbeats as a trade, or are you just going to do single issues?
Yeah, so that's the other thing too. Thanks for asking. It will be released in the trade in late June, early July.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be solicited in this month's previews as a trade. Yeah, it's all 4 issues with some nice pinups in the back. I have about like 4 or 5 pinups from. Few artists that I love, and they did some pinups for me. So
No, yeah. I can't believe this is all you have in mind. Do you have other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
Ultrabot is right now the big one. Like, I really want to see that come into fruition. It's the one I'm the most proud of. Like, I love Offbeat, so that was my first one. It has its kinks, you know, like every first project does. Mm-hmm. But Ultrabot Go 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 came out. I envisioned something, and it came out even better than what I was hoping for. Like, it really, I love it. I think it really, it really mirrors that. Like, I think I sent you a link to a giant robo, and I don't know if you got to look at that. Mm-hmm. If you actually compare the pages and the style, and the use of camera, the composing, pacing.
Very cool.
So that's really in the forefront. I have two other ideas. Can't really talk about them.
Okay.
I don't know if they would ever come into fruition. It's kind of hard because, I do pay my artists and, and I live in Manhattan. It's not cheap and I don't make a lot of money. So I think I'm going to try this idea of crowdfunding and see how it goes and have some success with it. I'm going to go forward with that. Or if a great publisher with some big cash wants to pay page rates, I'm down with that. They want to approach me. Mm-hmm. That'd be awesome, but I doubt that will happen. But you never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, both of these would make great animated shows.
Yeah, all my concepts, all my comics, because I come from I love animation, and visually that's what I'm going from. Going for this it's a through line through my work. It's a very animated style. I would love that. I'm not into comics for the Hollywood thing. Mm-hmm. I'm actually I have very mixed feelings about that personally. Mm-hmm. What the industry has become, it's now kowtowing to that. Is that the word? Kowtow?
Mm-hmm.
To Hollywood. And I miss, in some ways, the implosion of the 90s, or at least independently. You just got to do whatever you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew what you were doing. Like, just if you're into comics, Hollywood didn't know it, didn't care about it. But if, Hollywood comes my way and they want to option stuff, I'm not going to say no. It's stupid not to.
Gives you more money to do some other stuff and pay for other things.
Whatever it may be, I played a lottery. So if I win the lottery, I'll become a publisher. So there you go.
All right. Yeah. So that's good. So again, it's Offbeats and it's Ultrabot Go Go Go. So get to your local shop and tell them that you want those books. And you said you were on social media. Maybe you should spell your last name.
I'm on Facebook and on Facebook it's Tom Sacchi, and Twitter it's Tom Sacchi, and that's Sacchi. Mm-hmm. On Instagram it's Tom Sacchi Comics, and with Offbeat and Ultrabot Go Go Go, just do searches on all your favorite social media like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just do Offbeats Comic, it'll come up, and Ultrabot Go Go Go. I believe it's all Ultrabot Go 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 on all the social media, so pretty easy to find.
Great. Well, you're doing good stuff, Tom. I really enjoy it. It's lots and lots of fun. Like I said, I don't get much adventure in my reading diet and comics. It's nice that you're doing that, so I really like that.
Yeah, trying to bring that back. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to talk again when you get your Kickstarter going, because I often talk to Kickstarter folks, and we can see if we can't promote that. Get that going. Well, Tom, keep it up. You're doing good stuff. I can't wait to see what else you're going to do, because these guys are really, really, really strong offerings, and I think that I can't wait to see what you're going to do next, as well as these. I recommend these highly, and I can't wait to see what's coming in the future from you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this, Wayne.
That's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.